Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's July 14th. 61 degrees here in Old Town Park City, and we've got partly cloudy skies. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. We continue to see that we have partly cloudy skies for the next few hours, and then that becomes the possibility of seeing some chance of thunderstorms, so that is something to keep in mind. We also will have temperatures ranging around the mid-80s, and then going into tonight, we start to clear out slightly. We'll see that temperatures will reach to a low of 59, and we'll have, again, those mostly clear skies. Thursday, we're expecting to see another nice day where we start off on the sunny to mostly sunny side, and then by the time we get towards the afternoon hours, as that moisture still hangs around in our atmosphere, we'll see that we have the possibility of some thunderstorms for us. We'll see a high of 85, and then as we go into Thursday night, a low of 59, where we start to see a small amount of smoke still hanging around from the fires out west. Luckily, that shower activity should help us wash out some of that from our atmosphere. And going into Friday also, we still have that slight chance of thunderstorms, but we start to warm up a little as we start to see the return of high pressure with a high of 86 in mostly sunny skies. Friday night, we still have clouds linger for us and still see that slight chance of thunderstorms lasting until the evening time. We'll see a low of 60. Saturday will be a much drier and sunnier kind of day. Again, high pressure really dominating our area, where we'll see a high of 87. Saturday night, we'll see mostly clear skies, a low of 62. Sunday will be another repeat kind of day, actually a little bit warmer with a high of 90 with plenty of sunshine. But by the time we get towards the evening side, we'll see a little bit more cloud cover, low of 64. And then as we go into Monday, we start to see the slight chance of showers return again for us, mostly sunny skies with a high near 91. And by the time we get to Monday night, that shower activity lasts a little bit until the evening time. But then after that, we start to dry out a bit more, partly cloudy skies. Low is going to be at 65. Tuesday, we continue to see, again, another repeat day where we have that slight chance of thunderstorm activity, mostly sunny skies with a high near 89 degrees for us. And from the Pinpoint Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Over back to you, Leslie.
Okay, thanks, Cesar. KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with the chairman of the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, Thomas Cook. Later on, Assistant Park City Manager Sarah Pierce and Economic Development Manager Jonathan Weidenhammer will be in with a preview of this week's City Council meeting, including a new program that could have the city pay residents to place deed restrictions on their homes and condos. Finally, incoming Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant with an update on the increasing numbers of COVID-19 cases in the county. Stay tuned. Taking a look at some local news first, Summit County Health Director Rich Bullo reported to the Health Board Monday that the county's COVID numbers are still in good shape, although they are inching up a bit. He said that there are troubling signs that the pandemic is not over. Given the low vaccination numbers on the east side, one board member is expecting that kids will be going back to school this fall in masks. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more.
Health Board member Doug Evans, talking with colleague Mark Watterson and Bullo, said he's discouraged about the prospects for the coming school year, less than 2 months away.
It breaks my heart after all of this that our kids are going to go back to school with masks. Why are only 16% of kids 12 to 15 in Eastern Summit County vaccinated? That number is why we're going to be going back to school in masks.
Here's the catch, though. The legislature is, and the governor all said there's no masks that are going to be required in the fall of any age group.
Doesn't sound like reality to me.
Why did we wear them last year?
Bullo told the board that while the number of cases is increasing, he hopes that number will soon hit a plateau. He said he is most concerned about the positivity rate, which measures the percentage of people who test positive out of an entire group who have been tested. The positivity rate in the county had been below 5% since early February. He said the rate has steadily increased since early June and is now at 5.6%.
And we've said all along that we knew we weren't going to wipe COVID out and that this is about managing a highly contagious communicable disease and made more contagious by the Delta variant. Right now, it appears that about 80% of cases statewide are Delta. one of the highest rates of that particular variant in the country.
Overall, Utah is showing the fifth highest case rate in the nation. Summit County is a comparative exception to that trend.
I don't want to diminish the importance of the surge that we're seeing. And I hesitate, honestly, to even use the word surge. Absolutely, it is a surge statewide. In Summit County, we're seeing an increase, but it isn't at this point in time a real alarming increase. You know, we're seeing somewhere in the ballpark of four cases a day across the county, the majority of those being adjusted for population in the east side. You know, not all that long ago, four cases a day, I would have been jumping on the table and ecstatic. So I just want to put that in context. We are seeing an increase, though.
Concerning hospitalization numbers, Bella looked at the state-level capacity of ICUs in facilities designated as COVID referral centers.
These last three bullet points on the gray line are 83%, 82%, and 81% full. A big part of that, as you would expect this time of the year, are just injuries due to mountain biking, hiking, those kinds of things, the things, seasonal injuries that you'd normally see. But there is also an increase, and this increase is of a concern. We've gone from 11% to 19% of the ICU utilization statewide is COVID specific. I was on a call last week with all of the hospital systems, were gave quick updates, and they consistently all said that they're seeing increases of COVID-like symptoms in the emergency departments. They're seeing increased hospitalizations, and they are generally beginning to feel like they're taking a step back in time.
He also reported numbers from the state that he said counter the assumption that COVID doesn't affect youngsters. Below said that since the beginning of the pandemic, over 80,800 Utah children aged up to 18 years have been diagnosed with COVID. He said 729 needed to be hospitalized, 45 needed ICU care, 80 developed MISC syndrome, which inflames different body parts in children, and two children with underlying conditions died. For KPCW, I'm Rick.
Well, due to public interest in the Utah Department of Transportation's proposed solutions for traffic congestion in Little Cottonwood Canyon, the department has extended public comments for the project to September 3rd. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on that.
The years-long process to find a way to alleviate the traffic problems experienced year-round in Little Cottonwood Canyon looks to be nearing its final stages, with public hearings scheduled for this month and the public comment period for the project officially closing on September 3rd. Comments may be submitted on the project's website, via email, voicemail, written letter, or in person at a public hearing. The Utah Department of Transportation released its final two recommendations for the project in late June. One option includes expanding State Route 210 to include dedicated bus lanes, and the other is an ambitious aerial gondola, which, if constructed, would be the longest in the world. Both options are estimated to cost over $500 million. Resort executives at Snowbird and Alta have expressed support for the gondola option. Park City has been looking into creative transit solutions as well and studied its own gondola option last year, but there are currently no plans for the City Council to revisit aerial transit in the immediate future. UDOT hosted an open house and public hearing on the project Tuesday at Butler Middle School in Cottonwood Heights. The hearing can be rewatched on the project's Facebook and Instagram pages. A dedicated virtual public hearing is also scheduled for July 20th. Links to participate can be found on kpcw.org. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
KPCW News Time, 8:16. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. The Stadtville Basin Planning Commission had a short meeting taking care of their agenda in about an hour last night. On the phone with a recap, I have the chairman of the Planning Commission, Thomas Cook. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Leslie.
Regarding the code change for bed and breakfast inns, you said this was like a cleanup on aisle 5. Was this a reaction to the Colby School application in particular, or were there other issues from other bed and breakfast applications?
I think that we discussed that. I don't think it's a reaction per se. I mean, I think it's part of our obligation to clean up the code. There's a policy or requirement in the general plan to make the code as clear as possible, and that's something we're always doing. The question of whether or not a bed and breakfast is an appropriate land use in our rural residential zones came up and was discussed, but the definition of bed and breakfast is on the books, and it was an obligation of ours to clear that up and further define it.
Yeah, so since the Colby application was submitted a year, maybe 2 years ago, I mean, are they bound by these new changes? It has been approved.
Well, in the case of the Colby School, we're bound by the judge's decision in the Third District Court. What we did to clarify the definition of a bed and breakfast in our code is, we made a recommendation to the council, so it's not a done deal yet. The council will review it and take our recommendation, and if they adopt it, then that becomes the new definition going forward. And really, it's not a new definition. We've just sort of clarified the ambiguity in what is owner-occupied residence, what does that mean? Because the previous case that you mentioned had questioned whether or not that there was a definition of that.
All right, so what is an owner who lives in an inn as a primary resident? I mean, that's the new definition?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, essentially what we did in the clarification of the code with the help of the county attorney's office is we just tightened up what that definition is. I believe where we landed, it has to be a person, a natural person, not the loose definition of person that can be a corporation or an LLC. They have to live in the residence as their primary residence and also be the operator. That's essentially it in a nutshell. So, we're not talking about owning an inn and then hiring somebody to be your innkeeper and saying that, well, they live there, so they're the owner-operator. It just further tightens up those criteria and takes out the ambiguity.
Okay, well, thanks for that definition of natural person. Now I understand a little bit better there. So can this natural person then be part of an LLC like Hoffest is or a family trust?
Well, I don't know the ins and outs of Hoffest at this point. I think where we landed with the language, I'm going from notes here, but it could either be a natural person with fee title in the property that resides there as their primary residence and then, becomes the operator of the bed and breakfast, or it can be a person who is a member of an LLC, because we know that, people do trust in LLCs to protect their property interests and things like that. So that was an item of discussion last night as well, was this too restrictive in the real world? And I think we arrived, Chris Conaby had some good comments about that, Crystal Simons, and I think we arrived at language that the county attorney's office is going to double check and vet before it goes up to council.
Okay, and I should mention that Hoffest, of course, is the current owner of the Colby property. So does this person then have to own 51% of a business that might own the property?
We really avoided trying to define a percentage because I don't think that, that's not our role to define what percentage qualifies an owner. And I trust that the county attorney's office has, crafted the language in a way that that's not really what, it's not our job to decide if it's 1% or 5% or 51%. I think that was a challenge with Colby School was we were getting pushed in a direction of trying to come up with a number as planning commissioners that qualified as ownership. That's we're talking about the land use and the appropriateness of the use in a rural residential. That's sort of where our roles are, and I don't think we're in the business of deciding what percentage, you know, qualifies somebody as an owner. It's really, you know, you really take those three words together, owner, occupied, residence. You get into trouble when you start breaking them apart and trying to define them in separate terms. It is what it sounds like, I think. And so the percentage aspect of it is not something that we're focusing on.
Talk about, if you would, then the philosophy behind this. I mean, it sounds like, I mean, the county obviously thinks it's important that the owner of an inn live near the surrounding neighbors.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a belief, or you know, if you look at bed and breakfasts, you know, there's a belief that if the owner lives there on site, there's, you know, there's a pride of ownership component. There's, because it's also your home, you're going to maintain a certain standard of being a good neighbor, even though you're potentially operating a business. And that's what we're shooting for. It's all about minimizing the impacts of essentially an in-home business in a neighborhood. And there's a belief out there that, you know, if it's an owner on site rather than a lessee or a hired employee or somebody who's given a nominal share in a business, but they don't really have that stake of, you know, this is their home where they live most of the time. And maybe we're wrong there. Maybe it doesn't matter. But that's what we were going for in sort of the plain language interpretation of what owner-occupied residence is and why that's important.
All right. A couple of planning commissioners wondered, is this code change going to make it difficult for people to develop bed and breakfasts in the future? What's your response?
My response is, I don't know. I mean, we'll see when the next application comes in. You know, there are other mechanisms that would regulate that. For example, you might live in a home in a neighborhood that has an HOA that says you can't do bed and breakfasts or nightly rentals, and you know that would be a further impediment to that. But I can't wait for somebody in the colony to apply for a bed and breakfast application. We'll see what happens there. But I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, at some point we looked at the land use table. So forget about the definition for a minute. And we looked at the land use table, and this is a CUP. So, you know, there's a process that has to be gone through, and we're given the opportunity to mitigate impacts to the surrounding neighbors. And we looked at, is this an appropriate use in the basin, you know, and we envisioned scenarios where when it's used in sort of what everybody understands a bed and breakfast to be, it seems like an appropriate low impact use in some cases. It we'll see what happens. I think that Colby School is the one that's on everybody's mind because it's been out there for a while, but I don't foresee huge problems, but if there are, we go back and look at the code again, you know.
All right. During the public hearing, you heard from one person with questions from Park West Village. The Planning Commission, as we mentioned, has approved the Colby Bed and Breakfast, and the deadline has passed for any appeals. But have you heard anything about reactions from the neighbors about that approval?
Well, just to be clear, we didn't. The Planning Commission didn't approve it. The Third District Court approved it, and it was remanded back to us to consider impacts. So, you know, it's a done deal. It's settled in court. So, I think when it was remanded back to us, I think we did our best to consider, you know, impacts, parking, lighting, things like that. And I think we arrived at a reasonable outcome.
All right, let's see. Regarding the second code amendment, commissioners didn't have much discussion and approved the change, saying that a special exception denied by the county council cannot be appealed to court. Is that even legal?
Yeah, I believe it is legal, and we were presented a rational reasoning behind why the code change was being requested by the attorney's department, and it already exists on the east side. So if you apply for a special exception to something in the code, you know, what you're essentially doing is asking the judicial body to give you a special exception, and then if they say no and you don't like that decision, it's a discretionary situation, and what this code amendment is basically saying is that the council is the final deciding authority, is it legal? Yes. I don't think our county attorney would bring us a code amendment that wasn't legal, but there's also precedent for it and a rational basis for why we considered bringing our code to be more in line with the east side there.
That's interesting. Okay, because I guess I thought you could take anything to the Supreme Court, you know, if it made it up that far.
Well, I mean, if you take a land use decision, for example, for a CUP, you know, I think that's a different scenario than asking for a special exception to the code. A CUP is an allowed use. So if we just travel back in time in our conversation to the bed and breakfast, it's an allowed use that requires a CUP. So it's in our code as something that we allow. So you wouldn't need a special exception to have a bed and breakfast in a certain zone if it exists as a CUP, because technically it's an allowed use. It just has some strings attached. A special exception is something different. That's something where the code, you're not asking for something that exists in the code. You're asking for something that's prohibited in the code. I suppose if you wanted to contest the code and write your own code and go through that process of public hearing and to change the code, any citizen is allowed to do that. But, you know, a special exception is sort of the antithesis of the code. So what we're saying is, sure, if you want to try to come in and ask for a special exception, you can, and it goes to the council. And if they approve it, great. If they don't, that's the end of the road.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
The only thing I would say is that we've had a string of rather short meetings, not giving you much material to report on. But as Director Putt says, you know, the planning department is busy and hopping, and we've got some big things coming. So we're not getting used to these short meetings.
Okay. Thomas, thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thomas Cook is the chairman of the Stanoville Basin Planning Commission. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:30.
It is hotter than a firecracker outside. Wait, we're shined in the world of firecrackers. What a horrible time to be in this world with no firework displays. Somebody needs to disrupt the entire world of fireworks. Come up with something with no fire. We'll just call it Litworks. We'll light you up if you listen to The Local View weekdays 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. This is Randy Barton. I'm your host. Local news, national news, international headlines, and fireworks. Tune in, my friends.
It's 8:30. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Park City Council will meet tomorrow starting at 3:30 in a study session to discuss a housing department work plan. In the studio with a preview, I have Assistant City Manager Sarah Pierce along with Economic Development Manager Jonathan Weidenhammer. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
And I don't know who's taken this, but the staff report on this Live Park City Light Deed Restriction Program is being prepared by an Elsie Katz. I guess new name to me. Is she an employee, a contractor?
She's an employee, new employee to us this year, working with Jason Glidden in the housing department.
Okay. An affordable housing specialist. She's bringing this program to the council for consideration and discussion. The Live Park City Light Deed Restriction Program basically incentivizes residents to place deed restrictions on their property in exchange for a cash payment from the city. Any idea how much the city's willing to pay?
Well, I think that's what we're going to explore tomorrow. We're really excited to have a variety of tools to attack this issue. It's going to take that to get us to a place where we're available, we have available affordable housing for people. And this program is super interesting. Vail and Breckenridge have brought this program to success, and we're, you know, looking, we've been talking to them about it, and we're bringing that to council to see if council might want to explore it for Park City.
Yeah, so why do you think this is something that makes sense for Park City?
I think we have to explore every tool. You know, what, there's not going to be one solution that fixes all of the housing issues in Park City. So every time there's a new tool that's available to us, we should explore it. And this one seems like a good solution for certain segments of our housing market.
Yeah, and there was kind of a list of potential properties, many of them condos. So we're not talking about multi-million dollar homes.
Right.
In the, okay.
Yeah, this is the basic premise of the program is that we, Park City, would pay out a percentage of the worth of the home as a cash payment as an incentive to restrict the deed so that whoever lives in that house has to be a permanent resident of Park City. So, and then that deed restriction carries over when the home is sold. So there's, you can still build equity. There's no restrictions there. It's just the restriction is the person living in the house must be a Park City resident full time.
Okay. So what would this mean then eventually when the home is sold? I mean, are they able to, you say, build equity at the boilerplate is like 3% compounded annually or something? Is that what we're looking
at? Whatever the market bears. It wouldn't restrict that in any way.
Okay. The report says it would cost about $1 million to create the program. What would they get us?
Well, I guess it depends on, you know, what the council, how the council wants to build the program. I think this is an initial step to discuss it, and then staff would go back and develop detailed means by which to implement the program and come back to council with that. So I think those details still need to be worked out.
Okay. And then in terms of the success that we've seen in some of the other resort towns that you mentioned, are they, the success being, I mean, what are we talking, you know, 10, 20, you know, hundreds of people doing this?
You know, I don't have those details. I know there's a report that's attached to the staff report in the packet that has a very detailed outline of how Vail has implemented their program, and that information might be in there, but I don't have that at the tip of my tongue. I apologize.
All right. Then at 4:30, a work session, following up on Monday's soil facility discussion. Jonathan, when is this 60-day engagement process expiring?
Well, technically it expired the 13th. So the first available meeting for council that was a public meeting is July 15th.
Okay. So you have narrowed it down, it sounds like, to three potential next steps about moving forward with this Gordo soils repository. One would be no action. Two would be a kind of a refined scope action and additional testing and policy evaluation. What is it that you're recommending here as a project manager?
We haven't brought a recommendation to tonight's meeting. Really, this is a step in the process, and it gives council the ability to choose their path forward. I mean, really, we needed to hear from the public. We wanted to allow the public a number of opportunities and ways to participate and give their input. Tonight, I would say, is not a final culmination, but it's a chance to check in and test to see where we are. So we've compiled everything we've heard. I expect a very robust public input session and public hearing tomorrow night. And then council can consider a few alternatives or pathways forward. But again, nothing compels them to move forward at this time.
The Gordo location is important to the city. It sounds mostly for the Arts and Culture District DIRT. And we have heard leaders say that testing there has been done. We have heard from others that it hasn't. So what is it?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that the Arts and Culture project shouldn't be a proxy for a policy related to whether we want to build a soil repository at the Gordo site. Our longstanding soils ordinance says that mining-influenced soils either need to be capped on site at a construction project or hauled to an appropriate facility, and kept within the soils ordinance, or hauled to a facility in, you know, Tooele. So building a repository at the Gordo site where we have an existing 35,000 cubic yard stockpile is the beginning of that policy choice. When you get to some of the other contributing or construction projects that may be in the future. There's been a lot of talk about the Arts and Culture site. We do have what I would say is significant information that we compiled during our due diligence of the purchase of that parcel. And we have a very good idea and are confident in the level of heavy metals that are on that site.
You've estimated some 60,000 cubic yards, so that's just a guess?
No, it was compiled by a construction cost estimator that has participated in the project management team, that's CCC through our GTS folks. And that's based on what the project looks like as a cut and fill across the entire site. The site drops 12 or 15 feet from the south end to the north end. And as they look at the concept design, it's backfilling and cross-filling and cutting for the parking garage and the other vertical elements that end up at the other side. And so they've estimated 60,000 cubic yards of potential bevel soils in that process.
All right. Let's talk really about bevel soil, because I've also felt like I've heard some conflicting reports on what is and isn't bevel exempt. And my understanding, bevel exempt is based on a definition from the Environmental Protection Agency. They are soils that are solid waste from ore and mineral extraction and processing. And those that have landed along the Silver Creek corridor there are bevel exempt because that's where they landed after this extraction process.
Yes, as you said, mining-influenced soils that have metals in them from the extraction process can be considered and classified as bevel-exempt. And bevel-exempt soils do not necessarily need to be tested. They can be taken to an appropriate facility. They can be kept on site and used for structural backfill, or they can, and be capped.
Okay, and that's where I guess I'm confused there, because what I'm hearing is that they are no longer exempted when you move them again. The reason that they're exempted is because they are where they are because of the prior history. The fact that you're now moving them, they're no longer exempted. So explain that to me.
Well, my understanding of that is that the EPA through the UDEQ has the authority to approve a permit for a facility or landfill to receive those types of soils.
Those soils, and we're not calling them bevel exempted soils. I think there's a technicality there. I mean, because we've got somebody saying that you can't move them because they're no longer bevel exempt.
Well, I don't believe that to be the case. Again, I'm not going to sit here and claim to be an environmental expert, but the process we're going through for the UDEQ permit specifically allows us to bring bevel exempted soils to a landfill repository.
Okay, I saw it. Should we figure that out? Can we just bring these tainted soils? I mean, should we just get the word bevel-exempt out of there?
I don't know. No, I don't think so. I mean, they're not tainted. They're contaminated. There's no doubt about that. They're contaminated with certain degrees of lead and arsenic and other metals. But they're classified through our soils ordinance and through the federal law as bevel-exempt soils and allowed to be moved in that they're not considered to be heavily contaminated. And so moving them to an appropriate facility that's capped and lined makes a lot of sense, as opposed to leaving them sit there.
If we were to scale down the project, I think this was alternative 3, there would not be an ongoing residential household program for those property owners, in especially the Prospector area, looking to build a fence, maybe dig a pool or plant a tree. Doesn't the city have some liability here then to provide something for these folks so that they don't have to haul the dirt to Willa? I mean, it was no fault of their own that the Prospector development was approved by city government.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all in this together to a degree. I'm not going to try to sit here and speak about who's liable for soils that the mining companies left us in the 50s. But the reason we brought forward a project that stayed open for a number of years was to work in concert with our community and our residents, understanding the financial burden that the soils can bring. But through the 60-day process, certainly you know as well as I do, the biggest criticism has been concern about dust and the ongoing kind of operation of that facility. And so I think there are some neat opportunities to have more fixed or discrete closures and opening times for fixed and discrete projects, We could have a summer where we just put the Gordo dirt in there. We could have two summers with a soft closure in between of 6 inches of topsoil where we open it back up and haul in arts and culture or other city projects. And so really it's a great policy question for the council to consider.
And something that we had talked about before, I mean, the city had gotten notice from the EPA that Richardson Flat basically closed. We do have a repository there. Have we found somebody to talk to about possibly reopening that?
And again, I can't speak to 10 years of strategy in dealing with the EPA, but certainly on the council's list is the Gordo project, if it moves forward, is a short, you know, 3 to 5 year look at 110, 130,000 cubic yards of dirt. We have in the operating units downstream from Gordo 2, 3, 4 million cubic yards of influenced mine dirt. And so having a longer term strategy is something that's always going to be on our agenda. We're going to have to continue talks with the EPA. Whether we do or don't do this Gordo project, we will continue that conversation with them. Certainly one of the options in the staff report is to have a focused short term relook at OU1, Operating Unit 1. And I think that's something council will probably consider heavily. But it's not like 10 years ago we quit trying. We've continued an iterative dialogue with the EPA and the UDEQ since then.
Yeah. And when we talk about regional planning, I mean, is this something that, I guess, why didn't we bring the county into these discussions in terms of trying to locate perhaps a joint repository?
And again, I don't want to miscategorize something I don't probably know enough about. My understanding is that we've worked long and hard with all our regional partners on potential solutions. And at some point, we had to go our own path in order to deal with a short-term approach. I also understand the county has been considering their options and how they're going to handle the Florence Gilmore dirt at the Home Depot area. And they're potentially accessing OU1 now. So I think there are regional talks that need to continue, and we need to continue paths that represent both our communities respectively and then how we work together regionally.
All right, so a public hearing is set for 6 o'clock. Is this the final public hearing?
Again, I don't think that it is. I would be surprised if council chose an immediate path of action. I believe, again, this is very much a step in the process, but this is a time to check in on the public input we've received and give council a chance to hear it.
Okay. Real quick, the appointment of Margaret Plain, is it that we're going to have two city attorneys, or is Mark Harrington kind of going on to act as special counsel?
Right. Actually, this is really exciting news for the city. This is a part of a careful long-term planning process that Mark Harrington actually proposed and put into place a couple of years ago when we brought Margaret on. Margaret will assume the duties and the title of city attorney, and Mark will move into a position as senior attorney, and he will be focusing on land use issues and community development, which he is so skilled at. And so we are incredibly blessed to have both of them and their many skills and years of experience as part of our team. Very excited about this appointment.
All right. And then the Park Avenue pilot project is, I mean, the responses to that are as varied as there are people. Do we have a consensus on what happens going forward here?
Not yet. This is just another touch base with council to let them know about the feedback we've received so far. This fall, we will begin an RFP process to hire a consultant to help us with the permanent design for that street. And this is a pilot project to experiment with some things before we make any permanent changes there. So we continue to welcome public input on that one. And, you know, it's developed over time. We've made incremental upgrades to it. We've added some planters. We've added some additional striping from when we first implemented it. And that's all based on public input we've received so far. So keep it coming.
So I think what we have done is slow the traffic, because yeah, people just kind of get white knuckled and it's like, where do I go? Because there is no center line. Will there be a center line in any future iteration?
We're not planning on it right now. You know, I'd argue that there's a lot of roads in Park City that don't have a center line, and that we're looking at this, you know, traffic calming measure that is a residential street. We want people to treat it as such. So it's an experiment. Like I said, keep the feedback coming.
Okay. And let's see, April sales taxes are in. How did we do?
It is incredible to see these reports. Now, April is normally a pretty low year for us, or low month for us in general. And that you'll see on the staff report that there's some really high percentages noted there. But it's telling. It's a positive step toward our economic recovery after COVID, and we're excited to bring these numbers to council tomorrow night.
Okay, and then the film studio master plan is back. We've had two council members serving as liaisons. Why is this kind of before the council, before it's before the planning commission?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I had the same when I was preparing to come and talk to you today, Leslie. The developers proposed adding some affordable rental units, and that would require amendments to their original settlement. And the council just wanted to explore that a little bit. And just kind of make sure they're all on the same page about it. And I think it's a good opportunity. Again, this is, as I said earlier, another tool in the toolbox that we can use toward our affordable housing goals.
Okay. And I just read that we need new library cards. How come?
I don't know anything about that one. Okay. I apologize.
I just saw something.
Can we circle back to you on
email.
That one?
Yeah. Well, apparently anybody with a Park City library card needs to come in and get a new library card. You'll need to have a piece of something that shows that you're a resident.
Okay.
All right. Sarah, Jonathan, anything else?
No.
I think we're good. I just, if people are interested in giving input tomorrow or listening in on any of these subjects on the council agenda, our website, parkcity.org, right on the front page, there's an icon for public meeting, and you click on that and it tells you how to go through the process of supplying public input, and we would really value that.
All right, Sarah Pierce, Jonathan Weidenheimer, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:48. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:49. Good morning. Well, as we've reported, Summit County seeing an increase in numbers of COVID-19 cases. On the phone with an update is Phil Bondurant, the incoming director of the Health Department. Good morning to you, Phil.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, let's see, when do you officially take over? September 1?
August 21st, Rich's last day, or Dr. Bullo's last day, is August 20th, and August 21st is when we see the transition become official.
Okay, and can you tell us how the search for your replacement is going?
Yeah, it's going really well. We finished up yesterday with our second round of deputy director interviews, and hope that by the end of this week we'll have a decision made. We had some really quality candidates from all over the state come up and compete for the position, and we're really excited and hopeful for the number or for the candidates that we had, and we believe we'll be able to find the perfect candidate out of that pool of individuals.
Okay. Well, when we look at the increasing number of COVID-19 cases, what's going on? Can we blame those numbers on the July 4th holiday? Can we, or is it just the fact that we have a revolving door of tourists?
You know, I think there's a number of factors that are probably contributing. I don't know that we could point a finger at any one of them. We look at what's occurring with the Delta variant and some of the factors around that and the characteristics of that variant and how transmissible it is and the increased ability or for it to transmit among groups. You know, I was in preparation for this interview, I was looking back at where we were at just last year at this exact time, and the numbers are somewhat similar in 2020 as they are to July 14th of 2021, in that last year we reported a positivity rate of 6.29%, whereas this year we're at 5%. And last year we saw just a little over 9 cases per 100,000, and today we report 9.77 cases per 100,000. So it's really interesting to see some of these trends start to pop up with COVID. If we've learned anything, it's that it's somewhat unpredictable on how it's going to move forward. And when we look at, you know, our vaccination rates in Summit County, as we've touted before, we're very proud of the way the community has responded and the way that our volunteers have helped get vaccinations into the community. But there's still a high population of individuals that are not vaccinated. And so with that, we should expect to see some increase in cases here and there. The cases that we are seeing tend to be localized to family events or events where people are not necessarily exposed in the community, but more so based on event where there was maybe a family gathering, some type of summer activity where maybe some of the precautions that we've been taking over the last year or so were not necessarily a high priority for that type of event.
So are all of these cases, are they of unvaccinated people?
Generally speaking, yes. 90 right now in the state, 93% of the cases are in unvaccinated individuals. So what we're seeing is that the vaccinations are performing as predicted. They're keeping people healthy. And some of the breakthroughs that are occurring, people are experiencing symptoms, but they're not to the degree that we would see potentially an unvaccinated individual. So, yeah, we would definitely lean to that direction that the unvaccinated are definitely at a higher risk, obviously, of contracting COVID.
So the other 7% are what we're calling these breakthrough cases where people have been vaccinated and still test positive.
Yes, on a statewide level, and that is accurate. Here in Summit County, we've only seen about 0.13% of individuals. So 39 of the 28,000 plus individuals that were vaccinated have been breakthroughs. So that would indicate that the vaccinations are performing at the expectation, if not well above the expectation of what was originally reported from the vaccination companies.
So these current cases, I mean, how prevalent is the Delta variant? I mean, are they all of the Delta variant?
We received some information from the State Health Department late last week that indicated that 80% of all new cases in the state are the Delta variant.
And how long does it take to determine if a person is positive with the Delta variant in terms of the testing?
The state is testing the better part of all the cases that come in, and it's, I believe, a 3 to 5 day turnaround time on when they can determine what variant or what form of the COVID virus is within the individual that's positive.
What's different about the Delta variant from the strain that we saw last winter?
You know, there's a wide variety of mutations, and as we know, viruses are constantly mutating and going through changes and transitions. But with this, there's indications across a wide array of publications and white papers that it's 40 to 60% more transmissible than the Alpha variant or the UK variant that we've come to know. So when you think about these transitions and mutations that are occurring in COVID, and with each one it seems to be that there's an increase in transmission, there's obviously concern there. Now, the interesting thing to consider is that the transmission is among the unvaccinated. So again, we go back to that conversation about, even with these variants, there's still a high degree of protection offered by the vaccines, even with these variants. Now, that's not to say that any vaccine provides 100% protective 100% protective factor against the virus, but it does definitely increase your odds to a level where even if you do or unfortunately contract COVID-19, the symptoms are much milder and the body is able to respond appropriately to minimize those symptoms and improve outcomes. So we're looking at really the conversation about, if you haven't been vaccinated or are considering it, it's highly encouraged that you do so to improve the potential outcomes should you contract COVID-19, which, again, is very minimal based on the numbers that we're seeing.
So at Monday's health board meeting, we had a member of the Board of Health blaming the media for the reason that they're not getting vaccinated. In fact, he said if the media would just shut up, his words, that they'd go out and get vaccinated. Did nobody challenge this health board member on that?
No, there it was definitely a topic of conversation, and we've received some outreach and emails regarding those comments. And there was, I don't know that it was necessarily a challenge, but there was definite clarification that was brought to attention during that meeting. But it's an important point to consider that there are individuals in our community, and whether it be right or wrong, that's not for me to say, but that is their perspective on this vaccine is that there are other influencing factors outside of the science behind it that are keeping people from being vaccinated. So as a public health professional and as a health department, we have the obligation to consider those points of views and understand that they feel that way, and then try to build around ways to educate and bring to light some of the information that we have about the benefits of the vaccination. And so it actually, and board member, you're, he represents the Camas Valley on the Board of Health, and he's doing his part to make sure that we as the health department have information made available to us. And again, whether that is right or wrong, or that's the representation for the vast majority on that in the Camas Valley is not for us to determine, but we do need to understand that there are people that feel that way, and we need to find a way to reach out to them and to speak on their level to help them understand why it is that we're so pro-vaccine in regards to COVID-19.
Let's see, vaccination rates, as we know, down on the east side of the county. And again, especially only 16% of those of the ages between 12 and 15. Can you talk to us about the science, about how prevalent reactions are to the vaccine in children?
You know, I haven't seen anything that would indicate that the reactions to the vaccine are any different in the children 12 to 15 than they are in the rest of the population that has been vaccinated. And while we focus on that number of 12 to 15 on the east side being 16%, it's also important to recognize that when we look at the 12-plus population, those that are eligible for the vaccine, using census numbers, we're at 78% complete, and if we add the 3% buffer that we've been adding, we're at 76% complete countywide. Those numbers are absolutely incredible, and in fact, the last I checked, they're the highest in the state. And so, yes, we want to hit 80 and 90%, but the realization is that that's probably not going to happen. And so as we look forward into the school year, yeah, there will be a concentrated effort on providing education to parents and in an effort to increase vaccination numbers, but we should not discount the fact that our community to this point has been phenomenal in their efforts to step up and be vaccinated. Now, is there work to be done in the 12 to 15 population as a whole? Absolutely. And we have plans moving forward and resources available to make that happen. But understanding that vaccination is a choice, all we can do is continue to promote that vaccination effort and hope that individuals will seek out vetted, proven resources as they make their decision whether they should vaccinate their children or not, and understand that there's a wealth of misinformation out there, and that if you're looking for factual information, that you would contact your primary care physician, that you'd contact the professionals at the health department to get that information and potentially make a decision based on vetted, science, data-driven information.
Real quick, I've got about 10 seconds here. The Triple Crown tournament in town right now, hundreds, if not thousands, of kids, too young perhaps to be vaccinated, running around town. Should we be concerned about that?
I think there's a risk with everything that we do and everything that we do. And so what I would advise is to take those precautions that we know of: social distancing, washing your hands, staying home when you're sick, and protecting those that are around you.
Okay. Phil Bondurant, appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is KPCW Park City.